Hello and namaste everyone. As promised, we are back with the second part of our A World in a Flux, episode 3 of season 2. As said earlier, in this part, our eminent guests mainly focuses on our neighborhoods, that is China and Pakistan. Please continue the episode. Thank you.
Now coming closer to home, China and Pakistan. Now first with regard to China, like on the Indo-China border, the things are not good. It's pretty messy. So how do you think it will play out? And, have we Indians have made right moves in the Himalayas now? Or the military establishment has gained something out of the Chinese to defuse this border situation? Or is it like, on the same pedestal as it was, in two years back?
See, first I'll give you a very brief interlude on later on, which my friend Hinja will also speak about.
Yeah.
The Chinese have a very unique philosophy. They believe that the Chinese emperor, who represents the Middle Kingdom, is kind of a heavenly kingdom between the heaven and earth, right?
Yeah.
And he controls the whole earth, virtually. He's a ruler of the whole earth.
So Britain doesn't believe very differently, no?
I they also believe that Her Majesty, Majesty, they also believe the same. But the
divine
Chinese,
right to rule.
Yeah, divine right to rule. That they carry that stick with them. Whatever. So the Chinese actually believe that, and they are very proud of their kind of a heritage what they have, and they have their systems. In place, like the tributary state system, where the Chinese emperor used to, dole out trading privileges. Mm-hmm. And, so what you see, the network which China has built up with OBOR or BRI, as we call it, which we have, just a second.
I guess from Twitter has again went down.
Again?
Yeah.
I haven't been online today.
Oh, okay. So I guess they have sort of okay. So Nabub sir is back.
See, the thing is, they dole out privilege. So what we see in OBOR or BRI, that BRI thing, it is like an empire, virtually, you say, and these are like tentacles of an octopus. Once they grab you, it will be very difficult to get out. The Sri Lankans have felt about it. The Nepalese have felt so many countries which have dealt with the Chinese, cheap money, have literally gone, bankrupt. We saw what happened with CPEC. It's really down the drain. It's got nothing. It's got nowhere. But the Chinese, at the same time, even if you go towards Africa, they will mine those projects. They will do anything. See, unlike America, who exports freedom and democracy, the Chinese don't impose their value. They say, if I'm going to do this project, what do I get in return? A gold mine, a copper mine, and access to resources. And to that also, they will take their Chinese labor along with them. So the Chinese work in a similar fashion the way East India Company used to function at one point of time, right? They started with the trading. You spread your tentacles, you grab those empires, you grab those countries, make them subservient to. So that is what Chinese psychology is all about. They cannot tolerate another hegemon in their nearby region. So which is why the Indian military and the establishment has to be very clear about, what our strategic objectives are. And, this is one area where I have some little disagreements over here. We did that informal summits in Wuhan, and even in Chennai. Let's be very frank. Pleasing the CCP will never help. Because CCP, you know, as India, if you'll remember, we have written in our book, the communists, you signed so many paper promises and paper contracts.
They have no value.
We have seen in Panchsheel. In Panchsheel, they will say, what Panchsheel they signed with us in 1954, they copied the same agreement with America. Can you believe that?
Going forward, the international agreement that was ruled about, you know, the South China Sea, in which the ruling was against China, the international judgment, even that one, they said is not applicable to us.
They went even further. What they said, the British treaty about Bhutan, they invoked that treaty to remind Bhutan, you know, what we are. But when it comes to some other region, let's say Hong Kong, they say your treaty obligations are not valid. So their hypocrisy is so writ large. On one area, they will say something. The other area, they will say do anything. And day before yesterday, I saw a pic of Chinese Xi Jinping standing, and there was a map behind of the world. Now, that map actually spread far ahead of Guam and put Hawaiian Islands, right?
Yeah.
Into the Chinese territory.
But why is that surprising? That is part of that island chain strategy. Yeah. And more importantly, when we were researching our book, this was really funny. So we would basically be reading these their old Chinese books just to understand CCP's thought process. And since none of us are conversant with Mandarin, you know, we had to actually work at translating. So, you know, it was a task. So there would be times when we would be a little, you know, we'd get a little exhausted, and you know, then like, you know, there would be some banter. So there was this one time, I think, when one of us joked and said, you know, I bet Xi Jinping wakes up every day and he looks at the globe and says, okay, you know, and he just blindfolds himself and throws a pencil and say, let's see what it touches today. I mean, let's see what new territory China is going to conjure up to having historical rights today. That's probably how they work. I mean, of course, everything they do is very planned, but it is just Chinese hypocrisy and Chinese revisionism knows no bounds.
Also, the way Chinese conduct themselves, there are no rules over there. They'll use propaganda endlessly. They'll use even Chinese diaspora as a weapon, in countries. They use Confucius Institutes to forward their ideology. They will sponsor scholarships in Harvard and everywhere. And they will make sure nothing anti-China is discussed in American universities, be it Taiwan, be it Tibet. No all sort of agenda is discussed. So, you know, like our establishment has to be very clear. The pleasing China never helped. And which is why I said, you know, what happened in Galwan in 2020, those clashes, that probably was a trigger which we realized during the pandemic, when India was going through the first wave of the pandemic and the Chinese were intentionally poking us. And we gave a very good reply, you know, a feisty reply to the Chinese at Galwan. And later on, Indian Army went on to capture the Kailash Heights. That is on the south bank of the Pangong Lake. But then what we did was, you know, again, we believed the Chinese promises, right? We gave up those heights, the Kailash Heights. And then in Hot Spring and Gogra, and even in Galwan, you know, we said, okay, you know, we'll go 2 kilometers back. You also go 2 kilometers back. You know, that's kind of a buffer zone to buy temporary peace with them, right? Mm. So, you know, there's a lot of chatter going on. Recently, the Tribune, I guess it was the Tribune or Telegraph, I don't remember, they published that China is now asking for a 20-kilometer buffer zone. In Debsang Plateau in Ladakh. This is exactly what they do. You know, nibble bit by bit, nudge you here, nudge you there. That is the standard policy. And why this is very important, you need to understand, you know, May, June, mein jo ye aaya, China ka jo stand aaya, which government of India frankly rejected, ki we are not going to accept any more buffer zone. 2-3-4 kilometers tak chalta hai to maintain peace, usse aage hum nahi lenge. But, why this happened? Because, you know, in November 2022, The Russians asked us, we required a spare parts back. Because we have to fight a war in Ukraine.
Correct.
In February, the Russians said, we cannot, give you the remaining S-400 because our military industrial complex is stretched to resources. We need semiconductor chips, which are not coming. And then we had in March, they actually started re-importing spares from us. And in April, the IDRW, one of the defense websites, reported that Indian Air Force actually asked, we need to start sourcing alternate routes for supplies of spares for Su-30, IL-26, IL-76, Mi-17 helicopter. So what did that do? The Ukraine-Russia war, allied with what China was poking us in Ladakh, made a situation, it hampered our defense preparedness. And that is exactly what translated into this historic state visit with America. Because India now realized the inevitability which was coming. And a very agile and a very dynamic country, always adjust to a very, an ever-evolving situation.
Correct. The reality dawned upon our establishment. Yeah. By looking all those things which are happening with China vis-a-vis
Russia. The reality was there. It was there for everyone to see. But a huge shift, I think, takes time. And typically, I think India has always been a very conservative country. So our changes are not very, very agile. And I think that is one of the things we will have to work on.
So I have to say on this. I think the current leadership is very much agile, and that's the reason the move has happened. Do you think? Do you agree with this? The current leadership is actually very agile when it comes to. It's very transactional.
The leadership is agile. It's also the need of the hour. It's also a global reset. It's also, I think, we've been pushed into way too many corners for anyone to to adopt the ostrich mindset anymore. The coffee is very, very strong. It is impossible to say that you can't smell it.
agreed. I think Navroop sir has yet to speak. Okay.
Yeah, so speak on China.
Tell her. Yeah. Yes, you continue. On China.
Yeah. So what has happened is, which is why one thing is that, we need to stop mollycoddling into the Chinese, thing. Even our trade deficit of China has doubled, almost really gone up to $100 billion now, right?
Okay.
From $40 billion in 2016. So probably we will need to, and very interesting line, I found William Burns, it was, of the CIA chief, right?
Who was
who's the recent
William
CIA
Burns.
Chief? William Burns.
Yeah, William Burns,
He made a very interesting statement that, look, we cannot disconnect from China. That will be a disaster for our economy. How badly China is integrated into global supply chain. And even Janet Yellen says that, the moment we disconnect from China, our economy will also implode. But they also said, we need to de-risk them. It's not about de-linking, but it's about de-risking. Which is why the Quad initiatives, like for vaccine supplies, for pharmaceutical API agents, for specialty chemicals, so all these important things for semiconductor chips, manufacturing supply line. Now today, Foxconn, which used to be totally dependent upon China, is one of the manufacturing all Apple products into India, right? So there is a significant movement in pharma, in chemicals, and India is one of the largest, smartphone manufacturers in India. And Samsung apparently has the largest manufacturing facility in Noida. In Asia. So, we have significantly gained. And so we have to de-risk ourselves, make sure we have our own critical supplies and probably take the help of the Quad partners in dealing with it. Yeah. And also, spruce things up. One of the critical features which we'll need to adopt is also about the blue navy. Because none of the powers which have dominated, you know, India is lucky. If you look at the map, India, you know, inversely India's map geographically. So, you know, it's like a triangle from where on one side you have the endless Bay of Bengal, other side you have the Arabian Sea, and below that you have boundless Indian Ocean. There is no geography hindering this kind of an, so we as a naval power can virtually control huge swaths of ocean. Britain was a naval power, which is why it was able, you know, it was able to sail to China. It was able to sail, it controlled everything. Then America is today the largest naval power. That lesson they have learned from the Britain. Chinese are trying to emulate the Americans. And I guess India also, you know, we also need to embark on that path. So that would be my focus areas if I would, you know, like want the foreign policy establishment, defense establishment of India to look into this. The mollycoddling on the Chinese on the Himalayan peaks is simply not going to work because they are not the ones who will say. And after you have signed these agreements with America, now they are pretty much clear, you know, like which way you are going. So, and the Chinese actually, you know, I actually said, you know, when all these agreements were signed and the Russia events happened, I said, President Xi Jinping will be, you know, giving a toast of champagne to President Biden. And people ask me why. I said, look, the America gets a huge boost in a partnership with India and China gets a huge boost in a partnership with Russia. So technically, the G2, you know, really, you know, both of them have got a significant boost. Yet, both of them are also interlinked with each other through economy. China holds one of the U.S. largest reserves of U.S. treasuries.
Correct.
So China is the, you know, like, it's like the bull in the China shop.
Multipolarity and bipolarity.
Yes, exactly.
ma'am, just a small question to you on the psyche of Chinese. You know, like groups discussed a bit about it. What do you think? Like, can you explain what, like, though Sir X explained, like, what is your view on the Chinese psyche, and what sort of effects it may have on India? You know, or how probably, you know, we should tackle with it. You know, to basically, you know, tell Chinese on their face that, you know, you guys are hypocrites. Your whole policy making is a hypocrisy, right? So how do we do that? How do we understand and then, you know, answer to them?
So, well, you know, I mean, foreign policy is obviously, you know, it's a mix of your tactics, strategy and diplomacy. Now, diplomacy would dictate that, you know, you don't tell a blind person that they are blind. So... But that doesn't mean that you don't know it. So, you know, and India has never been, I mean, I think India has always been a very civilized country. So, I mean, so we have always been very civilized, you know, whether it's in our speech, in our conduct, in our actions. So those have been our first principles. The Chinese first principles are very, very different. So, you know, I mean, first of all, I don't think any country should move away from their first principles just to defeat another. But yes, it's very, very important to understand how the other country thinks. So like I said earlier, you know, that when we were researching for the new global order, most think tanks, you know, especially even the ones, you know, in Georgetown, they were still pushing Russia as the enemy instead of focusing on China. Of course, I think for us, a focus on China and Pakistan was important because, you know, China being our neighbor, as on the basis of Arthashastra, makes it our natural enemy. So for us, you know, I think that was the reason, you know, we were researching a lot more into China. And then for us, it also became very, very evident that Russia was not the enemy. It was going to be China. And I think later on, many other think tanks. And of course, today, I think people are calling it out openly. But back in 2014-15, there were not too many calling China out. Also, the fact that, you know, that there is, so for us, like I said, first on the basis of what Arthashastra says, that a country which is our neighbor is our natural enemy, our neighbor's neighbor is our natural ally. That's the first part. The second part is we already have a history with China where we know they cannot be trusted. You know, like Navroop just rightly said right now, that the communists are all about paper promises. So we have a history, we know their actions, and which is why we know that they simply cannot be trusted. After that, if we also look at Chinese actions, China has never, has never tried to deny that it harbors expansionist mindset or a revisionist mindset. Like, India has never been a country which is pursuing an expansionist strategy. That is the core difference between India and China. I mean, India is concerned with protecting, safeguarding what she has. And China is only concerned about expanding and, you know, and is willing to go to any length to achieve that. You know, it started doing that with the creation of artificial islands. I think this was during the Obama administration.
Yes.
And yes, right. I mean, the Spratlys and so on and so forth. And at that time, you know, they kept quiet. They kept saying, oh, you know, we are just using this for fishing. We are just using. But for all purposes, it was territorial reclamation. Yeah. I mean, you know, you can word it very nicely. You can dress it up with as many fancy adjectives as you'd like. But basically, it is territorial reclamation. And at that, and it's very interesting because, you know, America used to follow the island chain strategy, but they never reclaimed islands. And they could not see China for what it was.
Agreed. And suddenly you had, you know, like military buildups on those islands.
No, but it was evident because, like I said, you know, so there is something called this island chain strategy. This was initially practiced by the Americans. Why? Because the Americans are the ones that are controlling freedom of the navigation of the seas, right? Hmm. Currently.
Right.
So the same strategy was developed by China, which is divided into two parts. Now, the island chain strategy basically aims at creating multiple layers of defenses, which serve two purposes. One, as far as China is concerned, because China is located in Asia, where all the action will be. So for China, it gives layers of protection, like fortification, and it gives it the control. Now, see, America has been very, very lucky because America enjoys a huge natural geographical advantage. It is flanked by water on two sides, and it is far away. Even when Russia was its enemy, Russia's location geographically was far. Even China's location is far.
Correct.
China's location is where the action is going to be. So now, why does this become important? You know, let's talk about some small stats. The 21st century is where the action is going to be, in Asia. Asia Pacific is home to over 50% of the global population, two of the world's largest economies, the largest democracy, the most populous nation, five declared nuclear nations, seven of the world's 10 largest militaries, nine of the world's 10 largest global plots, and the busiest sea lanes for navigation. So now you tell me, if there is a country which is looking at becoming, becoming the leader for global domination, will it not try to control the seas here? It is understood.
Correct.
So how is it going to begin? So it's going to basically begin this by creating military bases overseas, the same model that the U.S. has been following. Now, how does it do that? The U.S. was doing it independently. China will be doing it slightly differently. It's going to be creating bases in alliance, or then you have its economic partnership like the OBOR. Multiple ways. I mean, once you get entry and a country becomes indebted to you, there are multiple ways of reciprocation or recovering your debt. One form or the other, basically. Okay. So creating alliances and partnerships with countries. And it's interesting because so many of these countries are ones which I think the average person could not even identify on the world map.
Correct. I agree. Absolutely.
Right. So that's because, you know, that island chain strategy says the first island chain starts with the Kuril Islands. The Kuril Islands is the one which is in contention between Russia and Japan. Correct, Navru?
Yes, yes. 100%.
Yes, okay. Yeah, so it starts with the Kuril Islands. It includes Taiwan, which is why, you know, Xi Jinping keeps talking of control of Taiwan, because it's key. First island chain, Kuril Islands, Taiwan, North Philippines, Borneo, and the Yellow Sea, East China Sea, South China Sea. Now we come to the second island strategy, which is going next step further, which is where Hawaii, you know, when you mentioned about the map of Hawaii, that's where it's there.
Just to butt in, you know, in the recent map where Xi Jinping was standing, they actually showed Okinawa as the part of China.
Oh, I mean, damn.
I mean, China can show America as a part of China. It doesn't matter. They can show anything.
Anyways,
the second island chain is born in Marshall Islands in the north. Guam. Imagine Guam, where America has such a strong base. Guam, Palau in the south, and the waterways of the Japan Sea, Philippine Sea, and Indonesia Sea. So you know now what is interesting among all these countries, there is a tiny nation called Micronesia. Micronesia has a natural alliance with America. Their citizens enjoy reciprocal travel benefits. That lease, I think, expires in 2023. That's this year. And since the last 5 years, China has been pursuing the termination of American reciprocalship and the entry of China.
Oh, very interesting. I never knew about this country called Micronesia exists.
I mean, Micronesia is actually the combination of three places. But like I said, so you know, most of these places are places where most people could not even identify them on a world map, let alone point them out. But they are very critical, because with this, what happens when China is able to develop decent control over its first island and second island chain strategy, you effectively would need their permission, or you would enter the Asia Pacific waterways under their domination or under their control.
Like
I said, that at the peak of the Cold War, USSR controlled and influenced much more territory than the United States, even though technically the United States was the supposed victor of the first Cold War, simply because USSR fell.
Chinese
goal would obviously be to match it, if not better it. That's why all its actions, whether they are economic or cultural subversion, you know, which is what Navroop said when he mentioned the Confucius Institute, or he mentioned, you know, the funding, you know, big grants given to Ivy League American universities, so the Chinese thought process is introduced and is also not discriminated against. Or if we talk about you know, so many other things that they do. Even Chinese intelligence. I mean, Chinese intelligence is completely next level. There was an article that we had written a few years ago about the operation of, their intelligence, the MSS, the Ministry of State Securities. And I think maybe someday, you know, we'll probably do a podcast about it. It summed it up by saying every Chinese citizen is potentially a spy. And China is very interesting that just like Russia, they managed to do this for citizens that are even overseas Chinese, or citizens that were once Chinese and are no longer Chinese.
Diaspora, as we call it.
Diaspora. Yeah.
So, you know, like, I'll add to this. So, you know, like, all said and done, you know, the Chinese are, you know, one of the people understand, no, you know, China, we know what it is doing. Him and me have explained, you know, in our books, not even in this podcast, and even earlier on our timelines. But what is the feeling? See, you have to see that China's main grouse, or their, you know, the drive which drives their foreign policy, is the century of shame. When the Britishers and even the French, even the Americans, even to that extent, Russians and the Japanese, they all, you know, virtually landed on the Chinese ports and did all kind of, you know, subversion, did all kind of slavery on them, to that extent that in the second Opium War, the French and the British landed in Beijing and did a raid on the Summer Palace.
Right? Yeah.
And they stole all the artifacts over there, and they imposed such humiliating condition on the Chinese in those opium wars that the Chinese actually sought, you know, that, you know, one day we'll take revenge from you. So when the CCP rose, you know, they had a mission mode that, you know, by the time we complete 100 years, we have to avenge that century of shame.
It's true, because they have been, the elite Chinese have been one of the largest buyers of Chinese art. Chinese heritage.
And also, you know, so that is driving. And one of the reasons for grouse with India is that India used to be the ground for the opium grown, which was supplied by the British. You know, it's like your elite colluded with the British Empire at that time. But the fact is, you know, that we were under colonial rule. So the Chinese can ostensibly even not blame us for that, right?
Yeah.
So that psyche is what drives China, you know, makes them doubt us, makes them, and you know, there's a very famous incident when Xi Jinping went to UK on a state visit, and there was a state dinner with Queen Elizabeth, right? And apparently his wife, Peng Luan, who's a singer probably, had a makeup malfunction. Right?
Yeah. Oh, okay.
That was a very famous story. You remember him, that it was reported in tabloids, right? So everyone joked around, the quality of the Chinese makeup. And there was a sarcastic comment made by one of the British ministers, you know, on the Chinese. And the Chinese, actually, Xi Jinping shot back on the British leadership on the state visit when he was addressing the whole gathering in the state dinner, which was hosted by the Queen Elizabeth and Prince Charles, and virtually telling them, you know, that you are the third rate power.
Oh my goodness.
You know, we will tell you who you are. Yeah. So
that, they hold grudges.
Yeah.
They hold grudges. They don't know how to move forward.
And
they're also extremely two-faced. So that basically makes them extremely untrustworthy.
Absolutely. I agree with her.
Correct. So, thanks for that perspective on China, ma'am, and to you as well, Navrup, sir. So, you know, coming to Pakistan, now, our adversary, you know, our real adversary.
Jani Dushman, as we call it.
So, you know, I need your views on this, and then we'll have the last question from India, ma'am, you know, which I've saved for her to speak on. So on Pakistan, sir, right, you know, recently there was a coup d'etat by the Pakistani army chief, and there was this huge battle between PM, ex-PM Imran Khan and the current army chief. So what has happened? What the
hell is happening over there? Right?
Yeah. I mean,
okay.
And how it is going to affect us?
See, you know, there's a series of events where your listeners need to understand what exactly happened in Pakistan. Okay. On 9th of May 2023, you know, there was Imran Khan's leadership and his party men of PTI, they ransacked headquarters of army corps commanders. Somebody stole peacocks. Somebody stole, you know, stuff from their houses. They burnt military establishments, right? So it was virtually crazy politics going on over there. Then senior ministers like Shireen Mazari, Fawad Chaudhry, Asad Umar, you know, they were hounded out by Pakistani military. I still remember, you know, Fawad Chaudhry going to Islamabad High Court, right? And he was about to go out and suddenly say, "Oh, police, Ahi Punjab police." He ran back into the Islamabad.
Yeah, and then he was so tired, he was literally huffing and puffing.
You know, like, Islamabad High Court bailed out Shireen Mazari four times. And the moment she used to come out, the Pakistani military used to arrest her the fifth time, right? So what exactly happened is they put the whole leadership of PTI into in jail, and many of them then they came out and they signed letters of resignation. Okay, we'll quit politics. By Jaan Bakhsh Do Hamari, theek hai? Apne generals ko wo log keh rahe the. So, and this was actually a regime change operation. Okay, this regime change was done in US. It was, you know, they were the one who sponsored it, as I would call it. Now, this is very interesting. And this began in April 2022 when there was a no confidence motion, if you remember.
Yeah.
And Imran Khan had cited that note, that American Assistant Secretary of State Donald Liu, you know, that he is plotting, because unfortunately, General Bajwa at that time had wanted to, you know, wanted to make up with the West, because you have to understand that basically, the Pakistani army is primarily made up of the Punjab, You know, the Punjab province, the land, you know, the Zamindar, the Punjab, and they're filthy rich. That is the that is the core of Pakistani state or the military establishment. Now, those people living on US aid and arms for decades now, they made a life. They made, you know, they control all industries in Pakistan, they control assets, they control huge palatial bungalows, their kids are studying abroad in Western countries, right? So the army has milked America to hilt, right? So army did not want to, you know, they do not want the benefactors to leave them or kick them out, right?
Correct.
While this idealist Imran Khan said, you know, that Americans have used us, which is actually true. What he's saying was actually true, right?
Yeah.
And he says, you know, like, you know, it's time we put our national interest first, like what India is doing. He quoted Prime Minister Modi. And he said, you know, like, I don't know what struck the Pakistani Prime Minister at that time, that he ended up landing in Moscow on the very same day that they announced the Ukraine invasion, right?
Yeah, and the whole hand expressions, you know, wow, on the airport. Hey,
what a wonderful time to be here in Moscow, right? Right. So this led to the American establishment getting very cheesed off.
Hmm. You know? That was like very direct on their face. He was, which I think, which does not behove any leader who is serious to do this sort of blunder.
So all this was going on, and then there was, and you know, now what is up? But to understand how this project played out, see, on 14th of May 2006, let's tour a bit back in the history, right?
Yeah.
There was a charter of democracy signed between Benazir Bhutto and Nawaz Sharif in London that they would not target each other, and they would on the behalf of the military establishment. Nawaz Sharif went back, you know, Benazir Bhutto came to Pakistan with all that fanfare. She was assassinated by Musharraf in 2007. Mm-hmm. Due to the sympathy wave, the PPP came to power. Zardari became the president. But then Nawaz Sharif went back on the Charter of Democracy and tried to damage the Zardari-led PPP government by again going back to the military and started doing all kind of tamasha like the Don Leaks memo gate or the lawyers movement against the PPP government. But the PPP government managed to survive even after. So, you know, after a decade of military rule, you had the first peaceful transfer of power between, in Pakistan from a PPP government to a PMLN government, that is the Nawaz Sharif party. Right. But, you know, both PPP and PMLN managed to get past an amendment in Pakistani constitution, which say they took away the power of the president to dismiss the government. If you would remember, in Pakistan, the president used to dismiss the government like, you know, as chitthi likh di, khatam. You know, Farooq Lagari had done it with Benazir Bhutto once. If you would remember, Benazir Bhutto was twice dismissed on corruption by the president. The president became the judge, jury, and the executioner. So it's a banana republic, actually, you know, in how it used to function. So these two democratic parties got together, and they said, okay, let us clip the power of the president to do this. Let us get some democratic control back with the political class instead of the military establishment. The military was miffed, and what is this? Now, these two main parties have colluded together. And this is when they decided to launch the project Imran Khan. So how this builds up is very interesting. In 2011, the military establishment, you know, wanted to, you know, wrest back the ceded ground. So Imran Khan started opposing against the 18th Amendment. You know, he wanted to make Naya Pakistan, but he said, nahi, 18th Amendment, hatao bhai, Rashtrapati ko dobara power do, dismiss karne ke liye governments ko, right? Apparently, he was cultivated by former DGISI Hamid Gul, who is known for Afghan jihadis. You know, the one who cultivated Taliban, and he praised General Musharraf during the dictatorship, right? So this was the leader. And then, you know, when the Americans did the drone strikes after war on terror, he used to say, are Americans are doing this? They are, you know, he was a typical anti-Americanist clown, ठीक है, यू नो डूइंग ऑल काइंड ऑफ टैंकर, यू नो यू रिमेंबर दो टैंकर धरनाज एंड प्रोटेस्ट व्हिच यूज्ड टू डू, एंड ही वाज गिवन फुल एयर टाइम ऑन पाकिस्तानी मीडिया. ओ गो अहेड स्लैंडर दीज टू पार्टीज एज मच एज यू वॉन्ट, राइट. ये दोनों के दोनों पार्टी डाकू हैं, ये चोर है, ठीक है, वो मुल्क का पैसा खा गए हैं, यू नो वो काइंड ऑफ एक्सप्रेशन व्हिच ही यूज्ड टू गिव, यू नो लाइक टिपिकल पॉपुलिस्ट लीडर, यू नो हु डज दिस काइंड ऑफ. Then, Musharraf got hammered out. General Kayani came into being, right?
Yeah.
And General Kayani, you know, then they used another tool. They used Tehreek-e-Taliban Pakistan to dismantle the opposition Khyber Pakhtun and pave way for the first PTI government over there, right? So how Imran Khan was enabled by the military and how he went against the military is a classic case, right? Then what they do was in 2014, Imran Khan started a dharna against Nawaz government of corruption scandal about the Panama Papers leak. Right?
The old elites against the old elites of Pakistan.
Yeah, yeah. So DGISI Zahirul Islam, who had not met Imran Khan, they met Imran Khan in London to chalk out how to target the PMLN government. They planned dharnas, morchas, even the parliament of Pakistan was attacked in 2014. Right. This was a military getting back at PMLN. So now PTI was targeting the politicians. So Imran Khan had a lot of, you know, close links with military. DGISI Hamid Gul, Suja Pasha, Zahirul Islam, to Faiz Hamid, who ended up becoming the DGISI, as we saw during the when the Americans evacuated and he went to the Kabul and he did all that kind of nonsense. Right?
Yeah.
So the military decided that the Nawaz Sharif had to go. You know, it's enough. So they disqualified him through via courts, through Panama Papers, put them into jail, Adiala jail. Nawaz and Maryam, I remember that road show which happened. You know, they were taken to that jail.
Yeah.
Nawaz fell ill. They finally said, okay, you go to London. Maryam stayed here, you know. And she continued with the PMLN leadership along with her uncle Shahbaz Sharif, who was then the Chief Minister of Punjab.
Now to
further break the PMLN vote bank in Punjab, they launched a new radical party called TLP. Right?
Oh, okay.
So how the games were being played? So PTI and TLP together ran a campaign against PMLN, and in just as it happened, 2018 elections happened. PMLN was routed out. Its leadership was arrested. Some were bought over. Some were given money to switch sides. And they made sure that Imran Khan gets into power along with the help of other allies, MQM, and forming a coalition government. Right? And even the anti-corruption law was diluted. Journalists were arrested. Human rights were, you know, media power was curbed. You know, the military came back like a roaring tiger, with Project Imran Khan. But then what went wrong between Imran Khan and the military? In August 2021, US decided to withdraw from Afghanistan. Now, bhai, hum ja rahe hain, hamara kaam ho gaya yahan pe, right? Biden said. Now, General Bajwa wanted to good humor them. You know, please, that aid pipeline, that milking
must stop.
That milking cow must continue giving
milk,
right? But Imran Khan was playing a dual role. He sends DGISI Faiz Ahmed all the way to Kabul against the wishes of General Bajwa, right? So General Bajwa he's immediately called back to the headquarters in Peshawar. He's given, he's virtually marched out off and given a thrashing that how could you go to Kabul without instigation, without taking permission of the army chief, because Imran Khan was saying, no, I am the prime minister, who the hell are you? Right?
He started believing his story.
Right. So, and then General Bajwa also did one more thing. General Bajwa wanted he had a two-pronged plan. He wanted to reset ties with the West. One was that, and other was, with India. There was a lot of back-channel deals which happened in London and Bangkok between the two NSAs, which led to a LOC ceasefire in 2021. So that actually, that was over. And but Imran Khan was one, he went on rabble rousing, RSS, fascist,
yeah,
Ajis, okay, where you're not going to accept it. So he was really, putting spanners into the policy of the Pakistani army. Because they were economically, they were floundering, high inflation, no oil, even Saudi Arabia is threatening, we will not allow Hajj recently if you don't pay the money. It's like a begging bowl going to IMF one day. Kuch de do baba. Right? That's a weird country, really
it's
weird.
It's not a country, it's an acronym.
Right? So the crisis escalated when General Bajwa sent a summary to Imran Khan and said, please appoint my man as DGISI. He rejected, saying, no, I will not appoint your man. I want my man as a DGISI. No prime minister would dare cross the military chief and the policy dictum of the military, right?
Correct.
So that ultimately, it was such pressure was built up that Imran Khan had to sign off those papers and say, okay, right? Go. But military was done with him. Now military realized ki bhai, the Rubicon has been crossed, our policies have been crossed. The Americans are getting angry day by day because they wanted the airspace and the drone rights. They wanted the Karachi, Quetta, Kandahar terror pipeline to be reactivated so that they could target the Chinese interest in Central Asia. They could target the Russian underbelly and they could use that Afghanistan as a base once again to even target Iran. So the Americans wanted that access badly, and this guy was proving to be a populist who was not willing to bend the American line. And he was always saying, ye sari partiyan jo hai, America ke sponsored hai, Donald Lu mila hua hai, army bhi mili hui hai. So he was doing all kind of, he was like behaving like the Kejriwal of, of Pakistan. Right. And immediately the Chinese were equally, frustrated with them because CPEC mein kuch
nothing
raha.
Was happening. Yeah,
nothing was happening.
It was not moving at all.
It was like kuwe mein aap dali jao paisa, wo jai ja raha hai, kahan ja raha hai, kisi ko kuch nahi pata hai. So Americans were elated ki chalo, a decade after the long Pakistani military, Nawaz Sharif, the old establishment, the political establishment is now back in power. Imran Khan was deposed. PMLN government came into power once again. Shahbaz Sharif became the prime minister.
And together. And they came power in together. That was the irony.
Right,
they
right.
They came together to oust the Pakistani army, and now they are together with the help of Pakistani army.
And now look what they've done. They've purged. They've literally purged the whole military of pro-Pak, a pro Imran element in Pak army. Now, this was a fight between the have and the have-nots. Now, the Pakistani Punjab, were the have-ones who have got the milking cow and they've made the other parts of Punjab never made it anything at all. The other parts of Pakistan, Balochistan, they did not get anything. So now the problem is. And now they have prosecuted every Pakistani politician, military courts have been sanctioned, and ultimately this party will be dismantled, they will be barred out of politics, and we'll be back to the same old two-party system. The Charter of Democracy is deep buried in Arabian Sea. The military, which was running, the one puppet will rule the another puppet. So you see how Pakistan, which once looked to be coming back on the way of democracy during Benazir Bhutto's agreement with Nawaz Sharif, is now back to its old course. So this is how the whole thing has unfolded. And there's a very old saying, the more things change, the more they remain the same. And it applies to Pakistan fully.
Correct.
But it's also about the way the country was created. The way the country has been created, it's going to remain. They should just officially adopt the military and say that these are our rulers. I mean, it will save everybody a lot of trouble. And at least the Americans and the Chinese will know, right, who they're actually dealing with.
And Christine Ferrer actually the state that, normally states have military, but in Pakistan's case, it is the military which has a state.
Yes, the military has a state.
The state, yes, exactly.
Which is why it's not a country, it's an acronym.
It's an acronym.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Awesome. So, now currently Pakistan, this is a very short question, I had. Pakistan is, so currently now Pakistan is also dealing with the Americans as well as the Chinese, right? So do you see a shift happening in future vis-a-vis Pakistan? With respect to Americans?
See, Americans are more or less done with it. They have given IMF lending also, like rope it.
It's already happened, no? Technically? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it has already happened. The kind of agreements they have signed with us, they don't have anywhere in the world. Pakistan ke sath to dur tak nahi hue hain wo to. So, so we don't have those kind of agreements. They don't have those kind of agreements with Pakistan. And yeah. Pakistan is not turning into kind of a Chinese colony, virtually. Tributary state. The colony is a bit too much. I would say a tribute to the state of China.
That would
be a better.
And also, I think to give India credit, in the last few years, we have managed to dehyphenate ourselves.
Yes, yes. This was
dear neighbor.
This was the first American visit, but there was no talk of Pakistan.
Pakistan, yeah. Virtually ignored. I mean, the country was virtually ignored.
Dehyphenation, yeah.
Right. I mean, I think this was started by Modi himself, when he was in 2014 election, when he said, "Arey, jisko jinko marna hai, unhe marne do, apni maut marega." That sort of statement he gave with respect to Pakistan. You guys remember it in 2014?
I think one of his most classic statements have been. वो कहते हैं हमारे पास न्यूक्लियर बॉम्ब है हमारे पास क्या है भाई होली दिवाली के लिए बचा के रखा है something like that, right?
हमारे पास जो है क्या वो दिवाली के पटाखे हैं I remember that anyways
so this is last question we'll wrap it up after this so ma'am and this is for you so I would like to ask, what broader trends are we looking out of all these events which is currently going on in the world? How this may play out in the near of, in near or midterm time, or maybe the longer time as well. Just a bit of hints, sort of.
So the first thing that I think, we all need to understand that all foreign policy events or all global events or all global wars, historically, in the present and in the future, have always been about trade.
Right.
They have always been about trade. I mean, the focus has always been economics. Whatever has been used as camouflage to justify is different. But, the focus behind it all, the motivation has always been economic. So the same thing is going to happen here as well. We are going to see a lot of, when we say trends, the trends that are going to play out, we're going to see trends play out in two ways. One will be the geopolitical trend, which is where we see the different country alliances, the Quad becoming stronger, BRICS becoming stronger, some associations becoming weaker, so on and so forth. Those are the geopolitical trends. The actual ramifications of it are the geoeconomic trends. Okay, So currently, we are in the midst of a global reset with China sort of firmly staking its place as the second pole.
Yeah.
So we are basically moving from, unipolarity to multipolarity within bipolarity.
Okay, within bipolarity. Right?
Yeah, because during the first Cold War, there were two very clear systems. There was the blue and there was the red. But this time, we also have a blue and the red, but it's playing out very differently because each country has countries that are within its influence, but are not completely subservient to it. So for example, India is a democracy. In terms of democracy, in terms of shared values, in terms of first principles, we align with the United States, but we are not subservient to them. Because we are still doing business with Russia, which is obviously a part of the other camp.
Correct.
So we are not seeing, we are not seeing a black and white division. Hence, I said multipolarity within bipolarity. But the broader trend being bipolarity, which is, we club this as Cold War version 2, basically.
Wonderful. This analogy, right? Superb.
Okay, thank you. So within this, you know, so when we talk about another system emerging, another pole emerging, a very obvious conclusion is, you know, as a, you know, when Navroop said about global de-risking, what is de-risking? You know, when you are going to de-risk your portfolio, so basically it's about America put a lot of eggs in the Chinese basket, which they are now de-risking by putting them in other countries. Okay, so if this is what America is going to do, you can hardly expect China to become quiet. It's not going to stay quiet. It's also going to start building its portfolio.
Correct.
So what we are basically seeing is that we are seeing the emergence of twin supply chains, or we can say there is a complete supply chain global overhaul happening. Now, since we are in the fourth industrial revolution, we are at the cusp, you know, with artificial intelligence, with semiconductors and rare earths, you know, and REE elements, etc., becoming very, very critical, which is why America, you know, I mean, they could have targeted China for a lot of things, but one of the first things they targeted were the semiconductors. Why? Because, you know, you work with what is going to become critically important in the future.
In the future, correct.
Right. So everything which is around the fourth industrial revolution, those elements, you are going to see a very, very clear bifurcation. The other elements, you know, we will see de-risking. So that can happen. So some manufacturing, China will continue to do.
Yeah.
But the critical manufacturing, America will ensure that, you know, America does in-house, or it sorts of, you know, make sure that only its critical allies, they are the ones that are doing it. China will start to replicate the same system. So which is why I said we're looking at a supply chain overhaul. Since we are in the, you know, the fourth industrial evolution, you are rocking supply chain overhaul with smart manufacturing, because it's the tech war that's playing out. AI semiconductors, they are playing out.
When we saw
certain things play out during the pandemic, the vaccine philosophy, other rules that the government put in, one experiment that has been continuing for a while has been sort of a globalization. You know, even migration was, I think, to some extent, you know, a part of it. That is migration within the EU, which is obviously one kind of demographic warfare, which, of course, you know, I guess, you know, we'll have to talk about some other time. So when we say we are basically looking at global agendas, so the pandemic treaty was one part of it. As food security starts becoming important, you're going to have greater focus on GMO. They're going to have focus on fortified foods. That's going to come in. You're going to have the currency wars anyway playing out.
Correct.
Which are there. You are going to look at a lot of digitalization, which means digital currency, digital IDs, everything digital passport, so on and so forth. So that's basically going to serve two purposes. One, the amount of data mining that becomes possible. And the second aspect is the element of control, because it's a great way to control the activities of people.
Correct, absolutely.
That becomes another element. And then obviously that also leads to greater citizen surveillance. There's obviously going to be the fight for rare earth elements that we discussed in our second book, which President Trump tried, which is why, you know, there was the whole point of trying to broker peace with the Korean Peninsula, because North Korea is one of the largest holders of REEs.
Oh, got it. Interesting.
So Afghanistan notably also.
Afghanistan too, and I think Americans are trying to, and even exactly. China too is trying to.
Afghanistan is called the Saudi Arabia of lithium, by the way.
Oh, wow.
Exactly. So basically, you know, now within these trends, we are going to have a lot of sub-trends that are going to play out geo-economically. You know, so like I said, it's, you know, this is an exhaustive conversation, because each trend is going to give its own impacts of, okay, what is likely in terms of what's likely to come to India, what's likely to stay with the West. But yeah, these are the broader trends in terms of geo-economics, geopolitics, of course, that will play out differently. But everything is connected.
I'll add one thing to it, right? One final point.
Yeah.
The biggest cultural export of this 21st century is going to be the woke revolution. Right? The you know, that we miss, you know.
Okay, but I will correct your statement here. It is not this century. It actually happened last century, and this was started by Russia.
Exactly. Right.
Yes.
Oh, interesting.
The Frankfurt UDB School.
Would be very, very happy.
Yeah, the Frankfurt School in Germany. You know, like Antonio Gramsci. But anyway, the point is, you know, so that is going to be a big trend to control the population. Woke revolution, dumping of the masses, and probably, you know, gender fluidity. Because that way you disconnect your masses from the civilizational values and heritage. And once that happens, you know, Himja, if you remember that quote from our book where we used to say, once a man disconnects from his civilizational heritage, once the Marxist bug bites him, so then he disconnects from
globalist
his...
It's a globalist agenda.
It's a globalist.
So basically, you know, if you want to look at it in a different manner, a very simple way of looking at it would be the coming together of the European Union. You know, how European Union was a combination of so many countries, each having its own culture, and each country having so many cultures within itself. Because so many countries have been a combination of principalities that were originally principalities, right?
True.
Now they have come together. They came together as one common nation, one common with one common agenda, answerable to Brussels. Basically, that's where the agenda would be laid out. And now all being forced to aid Ukraine, with so many countries sort of now voicing their opposition. So when you are asked to sacrifice your individual desire. Now, when I say individual, I'm not referring to an individual at the individual level. I'm referring to an individual as a country. But you're supposed to do this for the collective good.
So
that's basically a globalist agenda.
Correct. Yeah. So, we are seeing the whole situation, you know, being developing in other parts of the world. How do you see, I mean, this may be very hypothetical, or maybe there's not a right question to ask, but again, I'll ask, do you see Taiwan invasion coming up, or Chinese will wait out, or they may do it in their own style?
It's part of the first island strategy.
Okay, I've got my answer.
It's part of the first island strategy. So the question is not will they, the question is it is very critical to them. It is simply about when and how and depending on the situation. But China has never ever claimed that Taiwan is not a part of it. And in fact, even at the recent US-Chinese conversation that took place, even the Americans have not come on record saying we don't recognize Taiwan as a part of China.
Yeah, that is true. And recently, Anthony Blinken also.
Exactly. I was referring to the same. Because, you know, statements that were probably said 2-3 years ago may not hold much context, but a statement that was, you know, passed just a couple of weeks ago holds a significant context.
Okay.
True. And, you know, to sum it up, you know, like for your listeners, I'll conclude my remarks.
Yeah.
The thing is that you have to understand on a broader trend, you know, like people tell us, oh, deep state kya hota hai, kya hota hai. You have to understand, look, Bill Gates visited China. And what Xi Jinping told, oh, you are a very good old friend, right? We know that NHS funded the research of the virus, you know. It's not fairly documented. Everyone knows it. Gain of function research was carried out in the Wuhan Institute of Virology. I have documented in my book, The Great Reset. Now, the thing is, people need to understand, you know, one is there is national agenda, the national leadership. Beyond that, you go to a global elite where you have bodies, where you have like G20, you have World Economic Forum, you have WHO, you have WTO, you know, through which all these agendas, as Himja, you know, pointed out, broader trends are implemented. Behind them are the philanthrocapitalists in America. Right? Or the transnational elite, what we call it, right?
Yeah.
Who bankroll these kind of agendas, you know? And behind them are the ultimate, you know, the families or the corporates or the banking houses, whoever they are, you know? So you need to, you know, it's a multi-layered thing. It's very difficult for leaders to, you know, pinpoint, you know, like India said, ki ye black and white mein nahi ho sakta hai. You know, it will, there will be good thing, there will be bad, you know, good and bad side to bow, you know, each agenda. It's as simple as
that.
So that's, I don't know, I would like to, you know, give my concluding remarks.
Amazing. So thank you a lot, ma'am and sir, you know, for taking out time to grace this podcast channel. And I think this has been a very enriching discussion on, you know, what is happening currently in the world and how we can, you know, hedge our bets on. And also, you know, it will help our listeners to understand the whole global flux which is currently, you know, playing out. And also, they can understand to read between the lines. They can understand to basically to remove the layers and to see what was the actual content in the events, basically. And also, absolutely, you know, like, yeah.
Because,
so,
you know, during the last reset, we basically followed NAM, which is why we sat it out, right? I mean, we sat it out. This time, we are participants.
Yeah, we are a part, you know, we'll be a larger participant. Yeah.
I mean, we are participants because, A, you know, the situation demands it, and frankly, we don't have a choice. So which is why, but you know, there is one thing that, you know, and it's very interesting because we come from a country that has written the Arthashastra. And when we read the Arthashastra, it is ruthless. It is cold. It is calculating. So, and which is why, you know, I think there is one thing that we must always remember, that this is our battle. It is our battle for a seat at the table, and no other country is going to fight it for us. And frankly, for any emerging superpower or any emerging, you know, nation, we must stop expecting any other country to fight for us. Because what comes to us through charity is pity.
Right.
And a strong country does not need pity. It is our battle. We will fight for our seat at the table.
Agreed, absolutely.
I mean, and for this, if we need to break our colonial shackles, you know, that, you know, they must be broken. As a nation, we have always been one that has sought peace. India has never been an expansionist country. But as the saying goes, peace comes when one is prepared for war.
Correct.
Perfectly summed up.
Yeah. So my further thanks to you, ma'am, as well. You know, you came for the first time on our podcast channel. And I seriously hope that you would grace our channel again and again for various interesting topics, you know, which affect us, which affect the humanity itself, which affect India as a nation as a whole. So thank you again, and thank you to our listeners. Namaste.
Namaste.
Namaste. Thank you.